from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out about a new exhibit at Garfield Park that includes historic photographs of the park.
I'll chat with Jane Fortune about her new book that looks at the women artists who helped Florence after an historical flood.
And I'll focus in on attorney John Krause's new photography exhibit. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call...
What do we do? All that and more right after latest news from NPR. Indianapolis's oldest park dates to somewhere around the 1870s, but it was renamed after the assassination of President Garfield in 1881. That's how Garfield Park started to become the stellar facility it is today. A new exhibition of historic photographs is on view through the end of February at the Garfield Park Arts Center, and Sharon Gamble invited the new Arts Center manager, Susan Watgrade, and gallery manager, Elsie Benitez, in to tell her more.
So, Susan, congratulations. This is a new gig for you, relatively new gig.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm so excited to be the manager at the Garfield Park Art Center.
And what is the scope of that job? What's the range of your job duties?
So I oversee the whole art center there at Garfield Park, which is the city's oldest park. It's a great facility where we feature not just visual arts, but we have performing arts, too. So mm-hmm. there is the McAllister Center, which is right next door, where we have great summer concerts that people come out to see. And I also oversee the classes that go on and the different events that happen at the Arts Center.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we have dancing, we have theater, we have the Shakespeare Company that comes in, we have lots of arts groups like the Photography Society that meets there on a regular basis. We have vintage movie nights. So it's really great for me. My background is mostly visual arts.
Right.
But
you've been a hands-on visual artist for a long time now.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's kind of been my love. But I really am enjoying learning about other art forms. And I've also done some writing. So we do have a library, and we are featuring the Poetry Society meets there as well. And so I enjoy meeting artists of all kinds and kind of, you know, maybe I'll participate in a dance one of these days. And
hey, you've got a few thousand witnesses now that you've said that on the radio, so expect your friends to be nudging you to do that.
Well, we'll see.
Elsie, how's she doing so far?
Yeah, it's been really great. It's always nice to have sort of a fresh perspective on things to improve where it can be improved.
Sure.
So it's been a pleasure, and she has such a diverse background of the arts in Indianapolis. She's had, you know, so many different jobs working with arts organizations, and it's really definitely a benefit to the Arts Center.
Great. So whoever wants to answer this, to refresh your memory, and there may be some of our listeners who've never been to Garfield Park, so I don't know what's held them back because it's been around for a while. Tell us about the history of Garfield Park. When was it built? How did it get built? Were there city leaders who said, oh, we really need a really grand public space?
Garfield Park is the city's oldest park. And it started off as it has a wide history. Like at one point, it was actually a racetrack. And before that, it was
actually for cars or horses. Horses, it would be.
Yeah,
right?
it was for gosh, you know, I'm not sure, Sharon. We'll have to look into that a little bit more. But I know it became a park, and actually George Kessler was instrumental in helping to build the conservatory and the gardens that were there.
Mm-hmm.
So that was built in 1913 and 1914, but the plans were actually carried out by Vonnegut and Bond for the sunken gardens, which are there. So that is a really neat part of the history because, you know, everyone's heard of Kessler, if not just for the road that we might drive on
right.
during the day. But the Arts Center itself used to be a community center, and it was also the pool for the park, and it was built in 1922. And so at that point, it became the kind of the central place in the park to go and to go swimming and to do all kinds of recreation. Mm-hmm. And that is actually some of those images will be featured in our upcoming exhibition that's we're going to be showing in January and February.
So about what year was it established as a park? This is post-racetrack time. So before the turn of the 20th century.
Yes.
And it still is this, other than Eagle Creek, which is kind of in its own category, isn't it the largest city park, Garfield?
It is one of the largest city parks for sure. Yeah, we have the Borrello Family Center there, as well as the conservatory and the art center. So there are three different facilities there, as well as the grounds, and they connect with the Indy Greenways. And we are really, what I think is great about the park is that we are really close to downtown. Mm-hmm. And so we also have a great neighborhood society, and we have a group that's helped support us called Friends of Garfield Park. And so there is a lot of community support for the park, a lot of users, a lot of people who walk their dogs, who come and are regular visitors. We have lots of squirrels there, too. And a coyote.
Oh, just one?
That's all. I've just seen one. But,
wow.
But yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Elsie, is there a book that's a history of Garfield Park, or what kind of research did you have to go on as you started assembling the exhibition of photographs?
Well, I started when I first started my job a year and a half at the Art Center as a non-resident of Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
I came in, and the first exhibition I worked on was a historical exhibition. A lot of the images we already had sort of in our collection, but it wasn't put together, and there hadn't been sort of like an organization done in terms of having it be a proper exhibition. So I started working on that, and then I started sourcing other images and pulling other things from various archives and just any kind of thing that I could get my hands on.
Sure.
And so that exhibition is still part of our permanent collection, and that's just the Garfield Park Historical Exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
And so this exhibition is its own entity as of right now, but after February, once it comes down, it's going to become part of just the historical exhibition. It's just going to basically, the idea behind it is just to increase sort of the amount of images in our permanent collection.
Mm-hmm.
And so for this exhibition, all of these images were sourced from a box, a random box that was kind of donated to me.
Really?
One of our other co-workers who works at the Family Center, Craig, he called us over and he was just like, they were going to throw away this box at another park.
Oh, that hurts your heart to
yeah,
hear that.
It absolutely does. Even before I saw the images, I was just like, why would you do that? And so he gave us this box, and I sat on it for a year just because I didn't have time to go through everything.
Sure.
Because there were so many images. And there was a box within a box, and just envelopes upon envelopes of old images taken
wow.
by the Indy Parks staff photographer at the time. So the majority of the images kind of start in the late 60s and go through the 80s. We have some older things in the exhibition, but for the most part, we're talking images from the 60s and 70s. And it's not just of Garfield Park, although I am kind of curating it that way. So
mm-hmm.
it has a focus on Garfield Park.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of other images from all the parks throughout the city and all of the sort of parks initiative programs that happened throughout the city.
Is there a thought, or maybe you've been doing this as you go along, to scanning and kind of making a more permanent record of these photos?
That is the long-term goal.
Sure.
What I would really love is to have the time to scan all of the images and give them to an archive that would just make these images available to the public
right.
without any fees or charges, to mm-hmm. just say, if you've been to the park, if you're one of the people in these images, you know, when you were swimming in the pool in the 60s, I mean, you should have access to it. And so I haven't fully worked out how that can happen yet, but that is a goal that I would like to see, because I think that, you know, these images deserve a home somewhere, and I hope that somebody will take care of them.
Yeah.
Because as of right now, they're not very archival, so they're deteriorating.
Right.
You know,
they're
as we
literally
speak.
Snapshots printed from the 60s.
Yes.
So if you picture in your own family the snapshots that maybe somebody hauls out at a Thanksgiving gathering, and they're starting to fade, and they might be a little dog-eared, and they may or may not not have dates?
The majority of them don't have dates.
Yeah.
Or even locations. The sad part is they're all serialized, so most of the images have codes, and I'm sure somewhere there's information that goes with them. Oh. I just don't have access to that.
We need to call Benedict Cumberbatch to come in and be the code breaker for this. So if anybody in the hearing this conversation used to work for the Parks Service and is saying, well, I can provide you the codes, stay tuned. We're going to give you a way to get a hold of these ladies. I know there's a fabulous photo of the pool that's part of your marketing materials. Tell us about that pool, which looks Olympic. It was Olympic size.
Yes, it was
right?
An Olympic size pool, and it was the main pool in the park up until the 90s when the family center was built. Personally, I don't know that much history of the park because, like, yeah. I said, I've only been living in Indianapolis for a year and
you're
a half.
You're a newbie, yeah.
Yeah. So, I've always known it as the parking lot of the art center.
Right. But it's clearly the place to be. There are, what would you say, scores, maybe even hundreds of kids in this one photograph from the 60s.
Yes, probably early 60s. I mean, just the idea of realizing that used to be the pool and the number of people that came through there every summer, every year, throughout the decades. I mean, it feels a little bit nicer coming to work just knowing that.
Yeah, there's continuity there. Susan and I have a shared past with the Children's Museum of Indianapolis, and one thing that there's, I don't think there's anything in Garfield Park that denotes this, a marker or something, and there probably should be. The Children's Museum actually started as an outreach effort at Garfield Park.
Yes, absolutely. That is part of the history. And another fun fact that we found is that at one point in World War II, there was some military offices and things like that at where the Garfield Art Center is. Yeah, and then apparently, well, I know that the park is as old as 1905 because there used to be a zoo there. And it was the Garfield Zoo, and I think they had animals in cages, those kinds of, I'm imagining like big round, cages that people would look at. And rumor has it that the bears from the zoo hibernated in what is now our second floor where we have our dance studio and our music studio, and we call it the bear room. So we have our art supplies and things stored in there,
gosh.
But it has a big metal door and apparently used to have a little plaque on it with a picture of a bear, and it said Garfield Zoo on it, and that was the hibernation room. So the building has an interesting history. I would really like to know more about that since the zoo was there in 1905 and then the building itself was 1922, so at some point maybe it was a renovation of some kind where they built on top of that, and there's this tunnel that leads to the bear room, which is kind of could be part of Haunted Indianapolis or something like that.
So military officers, bears, children, the children
pool.
Who became the first patrons of the Children's Museum, that Olympic-sized pool. It sounds like what we really need, in addition to more funding for y'all and more hours in the day, are even more people to share their memories.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we would love to have those stories to add to what Elsie is doing with building the collection and the historic documentation of the park. What's neat is Elsie was able to find some kind of home movies, I believe. And Elsie, correct me if I'm wrong, they're 16 millimeter?
Yeah, they're 16 millimeter prints, and it was also taken by the staff photographer. So it was in that same collection. Two of them were labeled as Garfield. And then we have three additional ones that didn't have a label. And so we have Eric Grayson, who is in charge of our great programming for Vintage Movie Night. I gave them to him to have a look at to see if this is something that we can salvage or screen to share with the public. And so he's working on that for us right now.
What a treat. In your box and other places in the resources you're drawing from, have there been any photos that surprise you, that make you think, well, I have no idea this was there?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of things that are really unique sort of about the images that are available. The thing that I really, really enjoyed going through, though, was seeing all the various animals in the city. There's one image of a monkey painting somewhere in University Square, and I don't know sort of what led to this happening.
I wonder if he was from the zoo from 1905.
Maybe. Maybe he was somebody's pet. I don't know. But it's a lot of images like that that just kind of make me really giggle and that make me really excited to know that these are things that happened. And there's also another image of, I think it was probably at Eagle Creek or one of the nature centers. And it was a people, they were sitting sort of in a circle and each of them had a different animal. And so there's this one image of a gray bunny kind of being introduced to a skunk.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's a lot of stuff like that that it's just really exciting and just really fun to look at. And I'm super into sort of 60s and 70s fashion. So seeing what everybody was wearing, I'm just like, why don't we dress like this anymore?
Well, people should dress like that when they come to see the exhibitions.
Yes, they should.
That's a great idea.
Sharon Gamble with Garfield Park, Arts Center Manager Susan Watt-Grade, and Gallery Manager Elsie Benitez. You can see snapshots from the past, photographs of Garfield Park, plus historic Garfield Park, through February 28th at the Arts Center at 2432 Conservatory Drive in Garfield Park. And you can learn more at gpacarts.org. That's gpacarts.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. When the Great Flood hit the city of Florence in 1966, countless works of art were damaged, and the city leaders reached out to artists around the world to make donations of contemporary art to the city to help create a new collection. Many women artists from all over the world responded, but their work was never shown until now. Local philanthropist Jane Fortune is the founder and chair of the Advancing Women Artists Foundation and the co-author, with Linda Falcone, of the new book When the World Answered, about this incredible art history story. Travis DiNicola spoke with Jane about the book.
Jane, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always a delight to have a chance to chat with you.
Always a delight to be here.
Well, thank you very much. You know, in the past, we have talked quite a bit about the work that you have done with art, and specifically women's art in Florence, through Advancing Women Artists Foundation. It's always been work from the Renaissance, Medici and such from that time period. And we're going to be talking about more contemporary art, which is kind of quite interesting. Tell me a bit of the background as far as how this came to be, this new book that you've written with Linda Falcone, When the World Answered, because it deals with Florence in 1966 and also to some extent now, but certainly not from the Renaissance.
No, you're right.
No.
This is an offshoot for us. Basically, how this came about was after we wrote Invisible Women, which has an inventory in the back of all the works of art in the state museums in Florence. Mm-hmm. And this is state museums, one of the directors of one of the city museums, who had told us there were no works of art in the city museums by women, decided after she read the book, she'd go down and see if there really was.
Take a look,
find out, you know, see if there is. Well, lo and behold, she found 107 works, and nobody knew they were there.
Wow.
So of this 107 works, there are about, and these are all by women, there are about, I'm going to say, 80-some that were works of art donated to the city of Florence when mm-hmm. the flood hit in 66 by women to replace the works of art that had been destroyed or damaged. And the foundation decided what we would do is we would take 31 of those works and we would restore them. Actually, they need more conservation than restoration. The older works obviously need more restoration.
Sure.
The newer works need just conservation, which is really quite nice. And that it would be a 3-year project. The first year would be that we would write a book about these women.
Mm-hmm.
And the second year would be WFYI, PBS, is doing a documentary on this book, based on this book. The documentary would be presented in 2015, and then the actual show of these 31 works that we have restored, conserved, whatever mm-hmm. word you want to use, will be on display, on exhibition, at Florence's newest museum, the Museum of the 1900s, for 4 months actually during the 50th anniversary of the flood.
Excellent.
So that was kind of our plan, and so far it's worked all right. The other thing I need to say is when the women donated their works of art to the city, they were the part of the hook was is that those works would be placed in a museum, be hung in a museum of contemporary art in in Florence. Unfortunately, as the works had not been seen that we found, they had never been seen, they'd never been shown, and that museum was finally built and finally erected this year, June in 2014.
So
it took 48 years.
The whole story is pretty amazing. Did you know yourself before you were contacted by this curator that she had found these works in the basement? Did you know much about the 1966 flood story before that?
I knew the story of the flood very well. I'd gone to school there. I spent my junior year abroad in Florence, so actually that was in 62. The flood was in 66, so obviously I wasn't there, but I was, I fell in love with the city, and I knew everything about that city you could ever hope to imagine. But no, as far as the artist went, I had no idea. And when I studied in Florence, basically, we never saw any works of art by women. They were never talked about. They were never in the books. We didn't go see them. So no, it was, I had no clue.
So let's give our listeners some context here. First off, this flood in 66 was just devastating to Florence.
Yes.
And it destroyed buildings. It destroyed artwork or damaged many pieces that had to be recovered. During the course of that, is it my understanding that it was the mayor of Florence who sort of made a call out to artists around the world, please send us artwork to sort of help restore? Or tell me, how did that come about? Let's start with that part
there. Okay, well, actually what happened with the flood, because actually, as you said, the devastation was overwhelming. It was they've had 50 major floods since 1177 in Florence, and 1966 was by far one of their worst.
Yes.
They had 14,000 works of art that were destroyed or damaged, basically destroyed. They had 1.3 million books destroyed.
Oh,
I mean, it was just, build everything. It was just, it was massive. The mayor of Florence at that time actually had not put out a call to replace these works of art. There was another gentleman that did that. But the mayor of Florence was actually the one he's the flood mayor, and he was the one that tried to get help, and that's how the Mud Angels came about. Actually, right after the flood, they had at that point, it was basically students from the universities in Florence that were helping, take these pieces out and try to save them. And then it just, as you well know, it just, boomeranged, I guess you'd say, and they're just masses and masses and masses of young and old there trying to save these works of art.
Sure.
What had happened before, there was a gentleman who had wanted to start a, I guess you'd call it a contemporary art museum of the Uffizi. I probably don't have the name right, but he, about 2 years before the flood, put out a call to men and women throughout the world to donate their works of art to this supposedly, this museum that's
to make like a contemporary Uffizi.
Exactly, and to donate to although it was just a plan on paper.
Right.
Then when the flood came,
okay,
brilliant man, he decided he would capitalize on that
and use that
as a kind of a stirring heartstring thing, and he did, and he was able to get obviously more works of art that way.
And what ended up happening was, hundreds of artists, contemporary artists from around the world, donated their work.
Yes, they did. There were many. I'm sorry, I can't.
Yeah.
I don't know as far as the men go. I'm sorry, we just
focused on the women.
But as I say, I know of 107 works, that were donated.
Incredible works. And so they weren't. They were donated, but then they just basically ended up in storage.
They were donated.
Wow.
The city decided, in their wisdom, to take them all. Mm-hmm. They put a $5,000 price tag on it, and I don't know what that would have been back then, but anyway, and then just put them in storage. They were just put in storage because at that point the museum was not
built.
There was no contemporary art museum. So basically, the city or all those people who, and the nice thing about the book too is that some of these women, not many, but some of these women, these artists are still alive.
Yeah.
So in the book,
we were able to interview them,
and that was quite nice too. The interesting part: these ladies are wonderful grand dames. I mean, they're just wonderful, wonderful ladies. And you'd ask them, you have to remember they were much, much 50 years younger almost.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd ask them why they gave their work to the city. And they had a little hard time remembering why back then. I can barely remember what I did yesterday. Yeah. So, but it was a cute. It was very. They were all darling.
And were any of them? I mean, surprised when you contacted them and said, "Oh, I totally forgot I even did that." Or yeah. You mean that work hasn't ever been on display? Or?
That's really that was the reaction. Yeah. They had forgotten. I mean, as I say, and because it's not on display, why would you remember?
Yeah.
And when the book was when we launched the book, we launched it at the new museum, and those works of art we have already restored. We restored eight of them, five of them they're hanging, and we asked the artists to come to see them, and a lot of them that they hadn't seen since they donated them, which has been 40-some years ago. That so it was quite, amazing. It's quite moving, quite moving.
This is a really neat place for you to go. I mean, as I mentioned earlier in the show, your work through the Advancing Women Artists Foundation has done incredible work in terms of research and funding restoration and discovering forgotten women artists in Florence from older periods.
Yes.
But this is totally new for you.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. I feel very strongly my feeling is we have to save the grand dames. I mean, those older pieces, because if we don't do that first, they are not going to be there. I mean, we found an Artemisia Gentileschi that had been in storage for 363 years that we restored, and it's now hanging in the Pitti. So, I mean, it's those kind of things that make you say, okay, you've got to do those first. But when this came about, it was such a compelling story. And the fact that some of the artists were still alive
and
could tell that story, you got to talk to them. It made it very personal. It made it very personal.
And you never intended for this to happen.
No. I would have said, no, we'll just keep going with the old grand dames, and that's fine with me.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So,
Jane, I want to ask you just about some of the artists in the book. I mean, there's so many incredible pieces and some great photographs of the work, both that has been recovered as well as other work by these artists. One that really stood out, Stefani Guidi.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sculpture that's in here, and I know that you had a chance to meet her.
Yes. We are very lucky again. WFYI is going to be doing a documentary based on this book, which will be put out, which will be released in the fall of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And we, in our interviews for the documentary, we were able to interview several of the artists that are still living, one being Stefania Guidi, who lives in Rome. And she's in her, I'd say her 80s now, mid to late 80s, and she is a ball of fire. I mean, this woman is incredible. Not only did she invite us into her home, she cooked lunch for us, which lunch was a 39 food spread with all of her family. And of course, they very few of them spoke English, and very few of us spoke Italian. So it was a lot of hands and loud voices and everything. But she showed us her house is basically full of all of the pieces that she's done, and she sculpts mammoth pieces, mammoth.
Yes.
I mean, they're huge,
mm-hmm.
and like in her house, one wall would be nothing but sculpture, like a mural of sculpture pieces all over. And her husband writes music, is a fairly famous music writer. And so he treated us to some little concert. And
how nice.
It was lovely. It was just lovely. So those are the kind of things that we were able, not only finding out about the work of art, but really getting to know the artist, who they are. And
I mean, so many different artists that I learned about that I was not familiar with until I picked up this book that I really enjoyed. One I just did want to mention, who I just really liked a lot because of sort of the interesting abstractness of her work and her connection to music, Beatrice Lazzari. I thought was just a really great sort of story there, and really interesting abstracted work that almost looks like musical notes or the staff of writing music, but then turned into art. Some really great work. There's a story that I want you to share that has a connection with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burden.
Yes.
Tell me about this.
Well, again, when WFYI was in Florence for a week filming this documentary, it was when the book was being presented, we had the opportunity to, at that time, in 1966, Franco Zeffirelli, the famous director, who's now who you call Maestro, made this his only documentary. It was called Florence Days of Destruction, and his sister had lived in Florence and called him. He was in Verona with Richard Burton and Liz Taylor filming, I think, Taming of the Shrew.
Sure, yeah.
And he called Rye television or radio, both, and got a helicopter and took his videographer, and they filmed the actual flood as it was happening. And they presented the movie about a week later, and Richard Burton did the narration for it in Italian and in English. And the documentary was done because to raise money to replace the works of art that had been destroyed or damaged. And they raised from that movie over $2 million.
Wow.
It's amazing. It's a very rare to be able to see it. And and so when we decided that when we were talked about obviously doing this documentary, we decided if we could go see Franco Zeffirelli, this would be absolutely incredible. And none of us really thought this would happen. And he led us in his home. He was the most charming man. I mean, just charming. And he said, "You just film anything you want. You can, you know, just anything you'd like." We were taking pictures of him with every famous person in the world. And, you know, I mean, and he just talked on and on. And he loves Florence. His big love is obviously Florence. That's where he was born. And we had probably one of the most delightful days I can remember in a long, long
time.
That's so
neat. And now, you've seen his documentary then?
We've seen part of it, yes.
Part of it,
yes.
That's great.
It's, again, very hard to get a hold of. Yeah. The University of Maryland has it.
Okay.
And it's not an easy documentary to get your hands on. Again, you know, it would have been almost 40. It's been 48 years since that's been made. But it was his only documentary, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But we were just, I mean, you know, you're in awe of somebody like that. And it was so wonderful because he was so, I mean, he was just like any one of us. He was so nice. He was just so nice.
Well, again, it's a great story that you've brought to light. That you know,
you.
I mean, from out of the flood, so many good things came,
yes.
And Florence is the better for it.
Yes.
And congratulations on this,
thank you,
on this book and on this work, and of course, on all the work that you continue to do in Florence through the Advancing Women Artists Foundation.
Thank you very much.
Travis DiNicola with Jane Fortune, the founder and chair of the Advancing Women Artists Foundation. The book, When the World Answered, is available locally at Indie Reads Books on Mass Ave. More information is available at advancingwomenartists.org, advancingwomenartists.org.
Hey, Sharon.
Yes, Travis.
I need to make a correction about something I said last week I'm a little embarrassed about.
Oh, no. What is it?
Well, you and I were talking about Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
And I am from Pennsylvania. I even grew up near Punxsutawney.
Uh-huh.
And I misspoke last week, and I said that if the groundhog saw his shadow, then we would have an early spring. And of course, it's the other way around, because this week the groundhog did see a shadow, and that means that we have six more weeks of winter.
Oh.
And I'm not sure how I misspoke, other than I was just dazzled to be in the studio here with you.
It's counterintuitive. It was the sun. The sun
was out
that day.
It was the sun. That must be what it is. But I just wanted to make a correction. And now that we have lots more winter, we'll have to find lots more things to talk about on that calendar we call.
What do we do?
What
I have something to keep you warm. Now, we've already spoken about things you can do on Valentine's Day, but if you're single, listen up.
Mm-hmm.
Pay attention. I know you. You're out there. You're single. You are not forgotten. At the Nickel Plate Arts Center on February 13th and 14th from 6 to... it's just on February 13th. It's Friday the 13th. That's even better. From 6 to 9 p.m., Make Art, Not Love. It's a mixer. It's an anti-Valentine's Day mixer. Groups and singles welcome, age 21 and over. $40 per person. Includes collaborative art activities, wine, beer, and snacks. There's no guarantee that you won't meet somebody you'll have a romantic interest in, though.
Sounds like a great idea. There you go.
February 13th.
Well, the one thing that I wanted to highlight is an event at Clues, the Marcus Roberts Trio. It's a jazz trio featuring Marcus Roberts, Rodney Jordan, and Jason Marcus. Jason Marsalis is part of the Marsalis family. I saw him a couple months ago at the Jazz Kitchen playing the vibraphone, which was awesome. He's going to be playing drums and other percussion as part of this trio, and it is an awesome band, and they're going to be playing on the night before Valentine's, Friday, February 13th, 8 o'clock at Clues. You can go alone, you can take a date, however you want to work it out. What else do you have there, Sharon?
Well, since we're on a Friday the 13th theme, you can see Silent Spring, the story of Rachel Carson and the battle over her groundbreaking work, Silent Spring. It is a film that's part of the Interfaith Eco Film Series, And it'll be screened at 7 o'clock on February 13th at Indianapolis First Friends at 3030 Kessler Boulevard East Drive. 55 minutes and go. You might meet some fellow eco-activists.
Very good. Well, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us next weekend on that calendar that we call
What Do We Do? Groundhog Free.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
In 2011, attorney and photographer John Krause almost dismissed an email as spam. But his attentive eye saw a detail that proved that the communication was legitimate. Sharon Gamble invited John to explain how a casual inquiry led to a photo of his being featured in the New York Times, and how he made the switch from film to digital, and what inspires his visual journeys throughout the world.
So, over a long career in the law, you've honed and fine-tuned skills in, I'm just guessing here, logic, listening, observation. Is there crossover from those skill sets into your photography career?
Yeah, people and things and places are always sending you a message, and it's a Rubik's Cube. You're trying to figure it out. And there is a design and a quality, and there's an image that has intrigued me over the years. And I'm an amateur, you know, photographer, but I enjoy it. And I've come to appreciate that I've got some talent. It can always get better, and an eye for seeing things. But it's always intriguing to me to see what others see and what can I learn from them on how they're viewing a site. A friend of mine spent some time in Paris, and the Eiffel Tower has probably been photographed quadrillion million times.
Sure.
And she said that someone gave her some good advice. How can she take a picture of the Eiffel Tower that conveys something that is unique that no one else has seen or seen in the same way as she does? And that's what will make her photo, and that's what makes photos stand out.
Wow. That's great advice for any artist working in any medium. You did a little bit with photography. You were a photo editor for your high school paper and yearbook?
Yeah, it was a little, it was a boys' school. It was Park School here in town
before
it merged.
Yeah.
And then there were not many of us, so that anybody that knew how to work a camera got multiple assignments. And then I had a Nikon film camera for years. And then my late wife, about nine years ago, I'd been looking at digital, and, you know, that's a big leap to go from film to digital. So she bought me for a Christmas present a simple, not complex, digital camera. And so I fiddled with that for a while.
And that started you on a series of taking courses around the country
and
beyond,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, good came out of a sad occasion in which I lost her in a tragic accident. And I decided I wanted to go do something myself. And I initially took a course out at Santa Fe Photo School on how to use your camera manually. I mean, life is more than just automatic. So that if you can figure out all the little settings and all the non-logical language that's on the back of your screen, then you're the master of your camera and it's not the master of you. And so I got hooked. And so I took some courses in Maine and Colorado, and then I decided I would travel. And it's interesting because photography travel in some of these courses is that you are with other people that are interested in the same thing, but you're by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have some people that understand where good scenes are, because you don't know to get up at 4 o'clock like I did in Wyoming one time in order to get the sunrise at the perfect time. I wouldn't have known that. Somebody had to tell me that. Wandered out. And then somebody said, you know, you ought to show some of your pictures. And I said, well, okay. So I've had exhibits at Heron, the bridge on the Chase Building downtown, mm-hmm. multiple Patachews and some other venues in town. But I'll tell you a little story. I was very interested in street photography.
Define that for us.
Street photography is taking pictures of people. That's basically it.
Candid,
yeah. I had taken a lot of landscape pictures. But we all have this little psychological barrier in that everybody has a zone and nobody wants to go invade somebody else's zone. Mm-hmm. And how can you get comfortable with that? So I took a course in Havana, Cuba, in street photography. And the instructor was kind of brutal. He had us out walking around for 6-8 hours a day with other Cuban photographers. And you had to get comfortable. And he had a couple suggestions. He said, you know, don't walk around like a pervert and smile. And I found that when I was taking pictures, I'd go around, I ask him, you know, this whole dilemma, do you ask for forgiveness or permission? and sometimes you have to do one or the other. But I'd smile and I'd take some pictures and kind of motion and if they want to be included. And then I'd go over and show it to them. One day, one of the Cuban photographers took us over to an island and there was a senior citizen daycare center. And she knew that they'd love to have treats. So we all, a little group of about four of us, went to a store and bought some goodies. And so we put on a little party, and they were very happy to see us. And so I was turning around, and here is three little ladies in their, looks like running shoes, when they weren't, in rocking chairs under a picture of Fidel Castro. So I turned around and I snapped it, and I got them to smile. And the long and short of that is that the New York Times has a feature that they run periodically of where readers travel. So I figured at a lark I would send in this picture of the three ladies under a picture of Fidel. And lo and behold, about 2.5-3 months after that, I got an email from an editor of the New York Times. Now, I first was suspicious. I thought it was spam. Hmm. But he had attached a copy of the picture that I had sent in. And they wanted permission, and I thought, well, my goodness, yes, I will give you permission to run it. Well, it turned out to be a half-page picture in the travel section of the New York Times on a Sunday.
Life-size.
Yeah, it was. So the opinions of others of my photography kind of went up a little notch after that. We had a million readers see that. But it's been intriguing since then, and I've enjoyed doing it, and I've sold some works, but I don't think I'm going to be able to retire full-time on my photography.
A biggest change going from old-school photography to digital?
Yeah, you have to understand the same things that you might have done in the black room, mm-hmm. you're going to have to now do on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some fantastic things. But I had an instructor told me a couple of things. If you see a scene, stay with it, work it, try to find something. Just don't shoot and go off and do something else. And then try to get the photo correct when you shoot it. Because a lot of people say, well, I'm going to shoot this and then I'll clean it up on Photoshop or something like that, which is fine. But you're going to have a better picture if you try to deal with it originally when the scene's there. I was in Italy one time, and I engaged a guide that took me around, saw some things. And down below Sicily, there is a scene. If you Googled cypress trees in Italy, you would see this stock photo. It's you would recognize it in travel photos all over the place. And he said, he apologized for taking me down there because people were taking pictures of this thing. And he said, But wait a minute. Turn around and look behind you. And I looked behind him, and there was all these undulating hills and a single cypress tree up on the horizon. And that was my picture. And it showed me in a very quick way that as a photographer or anybody in general, be aware of what is around you. Look for the unusual and look for the thing that's not being seen by everybody else, because that's the photo.
You know, the skill set you just described, staying with the scene and looking carefully, that's what all photographers had to do, because you couldn't do in the dark room what you can do in Photoshop.
Yeah, that's kind of the easy way out.
Yeah.
I'm a mediator by trade, and I've taught that at the IU Law School here in town for years. And it's the same principle, is that there is a message. People that are in conflict are talking, and they're trying to tell you something. And you've got to sit there and figure it out. However, you know, angry, upset, emotional they are, and there's something in there that's the seed to the solution of their problem. Well, the same thing is when you look at a scene. There's something in that scene that's going to convey something to you and something to a lot of other people, that you've got to figure it out and what makes it unusual. And that's what makes a good photo. And, you know, I know I can keep getting better as I keep taking photos.
You know, there are some, and listeners who haven't already Googled John's website and found it yet, stay tuned. We'll give you that site in a moment. There's some photos, candid photos, especially in Paris, where I feel like you really unobtrusively blended in. I'm thinking, for example, of one. There's a woman sitting in a cafe reading a newspaper, and her expression is just so intriguing, and you're trying to figure out what is it she's reading about? How is she responding to it? So it feels as though there's a nice balance in your technique as far as how to be in the right place to photograph.
Well,
I was having some coffee and showing in plain sight.
Yeah, I was having some coffee, and she was sitting up at the bar having a cafe, some coffee herself, and reading a paper. And that's one of those things in which I ask for forgiveness. Because I saw the profile, and it was just classic. And then she turned around at me and kind of gave me a stare like, you took my photo.
Mm-hmm.
And I just smiled, and I said thank you, and I went on. Same thing is that you're walking down the street and you're seeing a couple kiss.
Mm.
You don't say, stop, can I take your picture?
You lose the moment if you do that.
The moment's gone. So it's, you know, you just kind of go with your hunch. And if somebody says no, fine, you go on.
You have a very intimate relationship with light in your photographs. When you're going out, you're planning, let's say you're planning a trip, you're going to photograph Yellowstone and the Grand Tetons or whatever. Do you start with subject matter or composition, or do you start with light? Where do you start?
You're making it more of a science, and I think it's more of an art. You're going out and you're just trying to wander around and see what's intriguing. For example, I've got a photo on my website called Ripples, and I was down around Ouray, Colorado, and the sun was coming up, and it was bouncing off a kind of an iron ore mountain, and it was casting a light over a lake. So I was looking at the lake, and all of a sudden a little breeze came up, and the light was rippling. And so I just was intrigued by this ripple effect. And I, you know, okay, I could get the whole thing. There's the mountain and so on. And that, to me, wasn't very interesting. But I zoomed in on the water. And the picture turned out, it could be a picture of, it's abstract art. I mean, it's the blues and the a little bit of the iron ore color in the ripples. That shows something. And then you're taking a picture and you're up on a mountain and there's thunderclouds coming in. And I look at that on my computer and it looks nice in color, but maybe if you flip it and look at it in black and white, and the contrast is good, and it gives you more power that way.
Sharon Gamble with photographer John Krause. His exhibition, The Grand Tetons and Yellowstone, is on view now through March at Cafe Patichou at 49th and Pennsylvania. You can learn more about the exhibit and about John's work, which has been collected and displayed widely, at krause.zenfolio.com. Again, that's Krause, K-R-A-U-S-S, .zenfolio, Z-E-N-F-O-L-I-O.com, krause.zenfolio.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll take a look at the Arts Council's Art and Soul Celebration.
I'll find out about an exhibition and conversation at the Stutz Arts Gallery about art interpreting violence.
And I'll get to take a swing at a book fair that is all about baseball. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call What Do We Do?
So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.